This is the Read, Write, and Create podcast, the podcast where you get a bite-sized session of creative writing coaching from me, Lori L. Tharps. I'm an award-winning author of both fiction and nonfiction, a journalist, and a former college professor. I've spent more than 20 years writing, teaching, and coaching creative writers, so I created this podcast because I want to help as many BIPOC writers as possible get their stories out of their heads and into the world. Are you ready? Let's go. On episode 27 of the podcast, I am totally geeked to welcome award-winning poet and debut novelist Philip B. Williams. Now, you might have heard about Williams because his brand new novel, Ours, was one of Oprah's most anticipated books for 2024. Here's why. Ours is about a conjure woman named Saint who goes around destroying plantations in the South and freeing the enslaved. She then creates a magical world called Ours, where the newly emancipated can live in peace because white people can neither see nor access Ours. And if they try, they meet with a gruesome ending. Sounds good, doesn't it? So Ours was just released at the end of February 2024, and it is an incredible novel, and Philip B. Williams is a master storyteller. Philip is from Chicago, Illinois, and is the author of two collections of poetry, Thief in the Interior, which was the winner of the Kate Tufts Discovery Award and a Lambda Literary Award. And his other poetry collection, Mutiny, was a finalist for the Penn Volcker Award for Poetry Collections and the winner of a 2022 American Book Award. Williams is also the recipient of a Whiting Award and fellowships from the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study at Harvard and the National Endowment for the Arts. He currently teaches poetry at New York University's MFA Creative Writing Program. Now, let me just say, this entire conversation is an exquisite masterclass. Philip is so generous and so knowledgeable with his writing advice. During our conversation, we talk about how we can use poetry to be better prose writers. We talk about what MFA programs are really good for and who should apply. And we talk about taking our time to write the stories that we want to tell. I am letting you know right now, you should probably grab a pen and paper and be prepared to take notes because you are about to be blessed with the words and wisdom of Philip B. Williams. Enjoy. Welcome to the Read, Write, and Create podcast, Philip B. Williams.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for coming. I'm super excited that you're here for this podcast. And before we get started with our conversation, I always like to tell people how I got to know your work, why I wanted you on the show. And so I'm not going to lie. I saw that Oprah's the Oprah Daily was like most anticipated books of 2024. And it didn't say that the order meant anything, but yours was the first one. So I'm like, this is got to be the most amazing book. If Oprah's saying it's her most, or the Oprah Daily, I don't know if it's Oprah exactly herself, but whatever. Oprah's saying this is the most anticipated book for 2024. And then I read the description, which I'm going to read right now so everybody can understand why I'm so excited. So this is how the OprahDaily.com described your novel, Ours. It says, in his debut novel, award-winning poet Philip B. Williams transports us back to the antebellum South, but with a liberatory supernatural twist. A woman named Saint has the power to conjure the destruction of plantations, rescue the enslaved laborers, and transport them to a magically shrouded haven, an all-black town called Ours. The formerly enslaved inhabitants of Ours are free, but freedom didn't mean safety. Dun, dun, dun. Fans of the Underground Railroad, the Water Dancer, and Let Us Descend will devour this lyrical and surreal saga. Unquote. Man, I was like, I must read this book and I must have this man on the podcast. So that's what got me so excited to read the book. But then because I'm a nosy journalist, I, of course, did a lot of research about you and found that you're a writing instructor, that you're a poet. And it's like, this is the exact person that I want to talk all things Black people, writing, magical realism, all the things. So that is why I'm so excited that you said yes and agreed to come have a chat with me today on this podcast. So, with that kind of a lead up, my first burning question for you, Philip, is what does the B stand for in your name? What's the middle name?
I never say what my middle initial is.
Never?
Never. There are friends who I've known for years and they've been asking me, what is the B? What is the B? I say it stands for B.
You know what?
That's for me.
I'm not even going to force you on that because I don't tell anybody who my middle name is either. It's,
I love
it's
it,
L. And I think that's maybe a writer thing. Are you trying to be mysterious about it or are you just like embarrassed by your middle name?
No, you got to keep a little bit for yourself. You got to keep a little bit for yourself. And so for me, it's a way to also separate Philip Williams, which is what I typically go by. I don't use my middle initial for anything other than writing. So if I were to reveal it and then people start using that, it would, in my eyes, ruin my writer name, which is, you know, literally just with the B. So,
oh my God, yeah. I feel so seen because that is exactly why I use my middle initial. It's Laurie L. Tharps, the writer, but I'm not Laurie L. Tharps. I'm just Laurie Tharps, but my author name has that middle initial in it. So thank you, Philip. Again, I'm never going to feel badly for using my middle initial that way or never telling anybody what it stands for. So wonderful.
Oh no, we see each other.
So I know you're from Chicago. I know general kind of author bio, which everybody heard in the beginning of the show, but can you tell us when you decided to take yourself seriously as a writer? Like when did that seed plant itself for you?
You're not going to believe it. First grade. I knew in first grade. It's not on my Instagram page, but the book that I wrote in fifth grade is up there. But I wrote one in first grade too. And it won a Young Author's Prize. And I knew that I always would want to do that, meaning write. But I think as far as understanding it could be a profession, that might have been in high school. I knew relatively early that I wanted to have books to write for the rest of my life, not necessarily as a career. I thought I would do something, who knows what, as a career. I went to undergrad originally as a business major, and then I had to transfer out to do English. In my mind, it was, oh, you're going to do what makes you the money and then you're going to write on the side. And it ended up not being that way at all. So
I love that. I love a young writer in first grade who already knows, got to write a book, already winning awards. That's awesome. So I know your first books that you had published were actually poetry books. And I just wonder, when people say, are you a poet? Are you a novelist? Do you make a distinction or do you say I'm a writer? Like, how do you define your writer self?
I love this question. I call myself now a writer or author. I had to make a new profile that took poet out of it. It had a good ring to it, but I always knew that it would become frustrating when people ask the question, which you did not ask, which is why I like your version, which is, how does your poetry influence your novel writing? It's like I was writing both at the same time. So there's not really that kind of division for me in genre. So yeah, I consider myself a writer because I want to write plays too and essays and I want to write it all.
Okay, Langston. All right. I'm just kidding. But now, so I know you did get your MFA. Did you do a poetry concentration, a fiction concentration? Because I know sometimes in MFAs, most times you have to concentrate on something, which I find foolish, actually. What did you specialize in for your MFA?
I specialized in poetry. It was poetry writing. And at that institution, I was allowed to take fiction craft courses, just not workshop. And that helped because there was a class there where it was really to get people warmed up to writing a novel, because even for the fiction writers in the MFA, it was for short stories. And so there wasn't really a venue or resource for those who wanted to write long form. So I took that class.
Now, you said, of course, you knew you wanted to be a writer from very early on. Even in high school, you were serious about it. A lot of the people listening are emerging writers and, you know, seasoned authors, but are still wondering, should I get an MFA? Is an MFA necessary to be a capital W writer, to get a book deal, to really learn the craft of writing? What was your experience? Were there pros and cons? Do you have advice for writers who think that they must get an MFA? What's your thoughts about it, just in general?
Well, I went to Washington University in St. Louis, and part of wanting to go there, other than the location, because it's close to Chicago and I wanted to be close to my mother, was the stipend. I got pretty much paid to go to school. So I tell folks, if you're not getting a stipend, then you probably will want to rethink that, because coming off grad school with a debt as a creative writer, that could be hard. That could be challenging. For me, I needed the discipline. I needed the environment. I needed the community. And I needed access to the library that WashU had. In particular, they had a fantastic poetry selection for pretty much anyone, I think, could go downstairs and look at it. But then they had what I used to call the main stacks at undergrad, which is their special collections. I mean, Amiri Baraka has letters in there. It's just amazing, the resources that you have accessible to you, depending on the institution you go to. So I tell folks, if they want to have time to write and also get money to do so, it won't be a lot, but it'll be, you know, something. And particularly if you're living in a city, a university town, it might be affordable to do it. Do not go if you want to be petted on your head and said how great of a writer you are, or you want to have, you know, perfect relationships with people, or have your work completely understood. It's for time to write, time to invest in yourself, go in that library, dig in the books. And, you know, you go to workshop, you hear what people have to say, you take what works, and then you leave the rest behind. It's not a thing for your ego. That's what I tell folks, because some people, they get frustrated because it doesn't feel like the most encouraging environment. And sometimes it can be a place where you have to leave. Like, that's not even up for debate. Not every place is compatible with who we are, but for me, the best advice was to get in there, use whatever time was allowed, and to use that library and get to writing.
Very practical advice. And I do realize after I asked you that question that you teach at an MFA program, right? So that might not have been the fairest question. But again, your answer was wonderful. And I think because you do teach and have taught and in MFA programs, I think your advice then, people should really take it to heart. So before we get into kind of your current status and your current writing life, I mentioned I'm a nosy journalist, and I saw that you also have a background in dance and choreography. And I'm just wondering, are you still, like, were you a dancer? Did you have to make the decision between dance and writing? Which very Maya Angelou, who also had to make that decision between dance and writing. Mm-hmm. And I'm just curious if there's, like, still dance in your life and if dance informs or influences your writing in any way.
I haven't danced since undergrad. The fact that that follows me is fascinating because, I danced and I choreographed at University of Illinois Champaign-Urbana. The group was Omnimove, and we did modern West African touch of ballet. There are a lot of hip hop groups on campus, and so we didn't touch hip hop. We let them have that, and we did everything else that we could think of. But for me, I try to see a dance concert every year, at least one. I saw Lines Contemporary Ballet, what was that, like a week or two ago? And Lisa Fisher sang with them on stage. It was unbelievable. It was just an amazing experience. And for me, the body being the medium in that way, the sole medium for creating art, has always been beautiful, taxing, because, you know, my knees are starting to pop and things like that. It's like, oh, yeah, to be able to maintain this as a career throughout middle age and maybe even late age is brilliant. It's always been inspiring to me to watch people dance. So I keep it in my life, but I don't dance myself.
Well, it's so interesting because, so I mentioned that on this podcast, I talk about our literary ancestors. And when I was looking at Maya Angelou's life, I always try to pull out things that people maybe might not know. And a lot of people know that Maya Angelou was a dancer. Some people didn't, though. And she said, kind of what you just said, that her body, like she knew she couldn't dance for the rest of her life, but she could write for the rest of her life. And also that she couldn't do both. She needed to put her whole self into one or the other. And so she had to choose, like she knew she had to choose. And because of the physical limitations of her body, she knew that writing was going to win, so to speak. A lot of people don't know that I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings was written when she was 40. So she had a long dancing career, right? It wasn't like she was making that decision when she was 18. But I just think it's wonderful. And I think it's interesting when we, like writers, I think we're artists. A lot of people don't necessarily claim that title, but just the way you spoke about dance makes me think that you're a fully embodied artist. Just reading ours, people say you're a poet and you can see that on the page, but I can also see, and maybe because I knew, but I can also see that you understood the body, right? The way you write about the body is poetic in like a dancer's way. Yeah, I just felt that. And I just wondered if you felt that kind of that dance part of you also influences the writer part of you, or maybe you just see it as part of your artistic self. Like that's just who you are.
I haven't thought about it in that way. Everything that we experience in our civilian lives, separating artists from civilian, everything that we experience influences the art, informs the art. So I think it's a fair analysis to say that the 3 years that I spent dancing informed my vision, the way that I see the world, the way that I see the body, the way that I hear the body interact with, you know, leaves rustling on the ground, or if there is a pop or a creak or something like that, the way the body can angle and curve. Those are things that I became hyper aware of while dancing, and also going to different dance shows and receiving information in that way. The poetic part of it just made it so that I could be precise in the way that I describe, you know.
I think it probably makes your observations of the body that much more authentic on the page, even. Like if you're not a dancer, you don't pay attention to the body in the same way. Or, you know, on the flip side, if you are a dancer, you tend to pay attention to the body in a certain way that muggles, you know, regular folk just don't pay attention to. You know, you don't notice what muscles are being used and how you're turning and moving. So it's just, I just love finding out like what are people's, you know, secret backgrounds that you're like, oh, that makes sense why they're so good at this on the page. And so on the same line, like you said, you don't see yourself separated novelist, poet, you know, it is your writing. But one of the things, obviously, that you are a very experienced poet. You're a very talented poet. You're an award-winning poet. And while you did say you were writing poetry at the same time you were writing ours, your same time you were writing fiction, your prose is poetic. Your prose reads like poetry in a lot of ways. I mean, I tried to read ours quickly and I couldn't. I was like, I can't. I can't do it. I was trying, but I can't. It was like, you will not. You cannot. It was like trying to eat a beautiful 10-course meal quickly in your car. You're like, oh, no, absolutely not. It's just like every single line is a feast. It's so beautiful. So I want to ask you, for all the writers listening who want to be able to express themselves on the page this way or similarly, how does one, if you don't see yourself as a poet, you don't identify as a poet, but you want to have that level of writing, how do we do that? How do we incorporate poetry into our lives so that it is incorporated into our prose?
Read it. Read it, devour it, you know, in collections from all over. If you can get translated works, that's fantastic. So for me, there's a poet who is part of the Negritude movement, Aimé Césaire, whose translations are usually always beautiful. It doesn't even matter who's doing it. But I remember reading poetry pretty early on, taking it most seriously when I was in high school. So Sonia Sanchez was an early influence, and Lee Young Lee, an early influence. And there were others. And what I enjoyed most is that there was still some mystery in the writing. I think what happens with prose writers is the unfortunate idea that everything has to be on the page in a way that is almost medical. Someone opens the door and that's all they do is open the door. They lay in bed. And so you're getting information, but the world is still not yet formed. So for me, the poetry is what distills the information so that you can have what is the purest form of the action. And then you start to say, okay, what am I looking at? Right? I know what the action is, but how is their face looking while they're doing this? That's a lot of information. If someone winces while they're lying down, or their body feels a chill when they touch those sheets for the first time, that's the descriptive work that is more than just decoration. It is emotional texture. And so I think it's really important for writers to not just want to get it over with and say, this is what happened, and this is, but to say, this is the world that I'm building, and the language is part of that world. There's a vernacular to the environment. There are sensations that each character feels individually, which is what makes them unique. Poetry allowed me to do that. And so it's just about reading as much poetry as possible, not necessarily what is popular. Read the works that intimidate you, that you may not understand, and then you build your own understanding. That's not really a right or wrong way to do it. That's the wrong way we've been taught to read poetry. But that's where the music comes from. It comes from our unique interpretation of the language that we take for granted, and we take for granted because we're so comfortable in it. So we have to find the mystery, and we have to find the discomfort. And that's where, you know, we get the challenging aspects. One of my favorite parts of ours is when there's a character who's drinking water, but he's looking at the character seductively while he's drinking it. And his throat is described as flexing down the water. And you can see the muscles pulsing in his neck as the water goes down. That's the poetry of it, but it's also paying attention to the details of the humans that you're rendering. That was a long answer.
No, it was so good. Look, I took notes. It's like, that was so good. Emotional texture. I love that. So good. That was poetic in just your answer. It was so good. But do you think that being able to create poetry is a talent, or do you think it's a skill that can actually be learned? I mean, like, everybody can write a poem, but like a good poem, like who can actually get the emotional texture on the page. Can you learn that, or do you think it's a gift? Because it feels almost like a gift.
It might be both. For me, I needed guidance. You know, even though I wrote early on, I did not know the tool set that I had, and I needed new tools to implement some of the gestures that I didn't quite understand how others did it. It's because I didn't have the tools readily available to me, or I had them and I didn't know how to activate them consciously. They were doing their own thing by themselves without my interference at all. I think there is a way to enhance the quality or navigate one's artistry in a particular fashion, but you have to study. It can't always be the easy way of doing a thing. If it comes too easily, then it's probably wrong. And I tell my students that all the time. It's like, you wrote this so quickly, people are going to like it. Just how people like fast food. There are billions of really poorly rendered burgers being eaten all the time. And you can do whatever you want with that. But if you want to learn about yourself through your own art and want people to figure out new things about themselves, as opposed to being validated, which is the easiest thing to do, is to validate someone else's experience, then you have to challenge yourself. You have to build a fortitude to, again, it's the word mystery. What don't you know, and how can you dive more deeply into that unfamiliar territory? And I really want there to be less intimidation, you know, when it comes to, oh, I wrote this thing and I don't quite know what it says or what it means, and other people don't get it. Other people don't have to get it. Somebody's going to get it. You'll find your audience, but study, figure out how other people are doing it. and mimic it, but don't copy. There's a difference. Copying is you're doing what someone else does and then you ship it out and say it's your own. Mimicking is what you do in practice. And then you figure out, okay, so for instance, if you have a recipe that a parent, a grandparent, you're learning from that recipe, but you might want to put pickles in it, a mustard in it, a little extra cheese. That's when you are creating your own signature on something. But we learn by listening and paying attention to other people who've been doing it longer, who do it in ways that are challenging. We have to be challenged or we won't evolve.
I'm glad you said that, that you have to study, that you have to educate yourself. You have to practice, you have to be challenged. And I love that the analogy with the hamburgers, like anybody can make hamburgers, but does that mean it's good? Does that mean it's an elevated hamburger? No, that's super helpful. And I hope people were really paying attention to that. And I hope it's helpful for them. I hope people feel okay with being intimidated and feel okay with studying and understanding that they can get to that next level with putting in the work. And that's okay. That's okay what we have to do. Awesome. So I'm going to now jump over more specifically to the book Ours itself, because I have questions. Now, no spoilers whatsoever, because this is too soon. People probably haven't had a chance to read the whole book yet. But my first question actually picks up from what we were just talking about description, about writing until it's complete. So Ours is almost 600 words. I'm sorry, 600 pages. Oh, 600 words. That would just be a nice poem. Almost 600 pages. And again, we're talking to our listeners out there who are working on their own novel manuscripts. And so many writers, especially debut authors, you know, first-time writers, are told if you hand in anything over 90,000 words, nobody's going to publish it, or it's that's too long. Keep it under a certain word count. Did you employ some conjure to like allow yourself to be able to write this long book? Like, first, as a writer, like, because I know this book has been in works for years, as you were writing, how did you give yourself permission to tell this story the way you wanted to tell it, as long as you wanted to tell it? And then if you could just kind of jump to, well, then once it was ready to present to your agent, to editors, was the length ever an issue? And did you say like, look, this is how long the book is, that's it?
You know, the answer might be united. I had been writing that, I started that book in 2006. I was an undergrad. There was no way I had the maturity to finish it as it is now. I needed years to pass, but I had so many different drafts of it. And what inspired me were the stories my mom told me about growing up and some of the, what many would call supernatural, but to her, they were regular occurrences that happened in her life, and family stories that were told to her. And I have a wild imagination, as you can probably tell by reading Ours. And I grew up, I can't do it so much now, but I grew up watching horror films with my mother. She loves horror films. And I always leaned into wanting to know, okay, that's the monster, or that's the ghost, but where did it come from? And so many movies are just like, here's the thing, you got to run from it. I'm like, I want to know where it came from. Why does it have four arms and not two? Why can it breathe fire, et cetera, et cetera. So I wanted to, you know.
I know you were a fun kid to babysit. I'll be like, oh my God.
Oh yeah. I always ask my mom, is like, well, did I miss the part where they described what it is that they're fighting against? Because it doesn't make sense otherwise. The story is what makes it horrific to know that it has this particular origin, helped make it more frightening. And so when they didn't do that, I was just lost interest altogether. But yeah, because it took so long for me to write it and I had so many different iterations, what happened was I actually found an agent who did not need the work completed. I could just turn in what I had and what I finished as I turned it in. So my agent, Bill Clegg, he was just reading it serially, like it was the 1800s in a newspaper, those serial novels. And yeah, whenever I finished a chapter, I sent it to him. And he said, "This, Phil, this is going to be a long book. Don't worry about it." Because I was worried about how long it was becoming. He said, "The story has to be as long as the story takes." And that encouragement allowed for me to just write the book that I needed to write, that I always wanted to write and always wanted to read. I knew it was going to be a relatively large book, but it was because Bill said, yeah, it needs to be this length. Everything you're writing needs to be in the book. And whatever doesn't, we will edit that out when you get an editor. And the editor said the same thing. He's like, yeah, this is a big book and there's not much that we can take out. But we went from 210,000 words to 185,000 words. So it was always going to be a behemoth, but there was always cleaning up to do. But I had encouragement from all sides.
I love to hear that because, again, I have a community of BIPOC women writers. I mean, we're like a coaching community, a support community, accountability group. And so I'm always trying to give them insights into the publishing world, et cetera. And you just proved a point that for every rule, you know, write the story that needs to be written. I think that obviously, in general, I mean, I'm not going to say come out the gate with your, you know, you've no proof that this book needs to be 250,000 words, but if it needs to be, it needs to be. And I guess it's great to hear that. I mean, this was published by Viking, so major publisher who said, to hell with whatever the rules are, we're going to let this story be told the way it needs to be told. So again, everybody listening, write your story the way your story needs to be written. Okay, so again, we're not going to do any spoilers whatsoever. And you already alluded to the fact that you have a wild imagination and that a lot of stories came up from family. But can you talk a little bit more? I mean, in this story, as we've heard the description already, but there's so much amazing root work happening and magic. Did you actually research some of this? Did you make up what you didn't know? Will some of these spells work if we should need them? I mean, some of them are looking pretty good. Yeah, talk a little bit about that. And I know you have an amazing author's note where you do actually talk about this at the end of ours, but I would just love to hear it from you, how you got such good, I mean, you deep, 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 the herbs, the spells, the incantations, all of that. Talk a little bit about how that came to be so good in the book. I mean, you did some world building here. I mean, this is real.
I did research so that I could be a better liar to make it convincing. There are some root recipes, conjures, whatever you want to call them, that came from the Black Book, which was edited by Toni Morrison, and also Zora Neale Hurston. She's written a lot of anthropological work about hoodoo, voodoo, conjure. And there are actually some books available that think of herbs as medicinal, which is root work. And so I've read all of those things and more, and I kept what made sense and I changed what didn't for the world that I was creating. So putting pennies in vinegar is a real thing, you know, but it only works if you believe it will work. It only works if your pennies are clean, if your vinegar is made right. You know, there are certain things that go with it. I wouldn't test out anything unless I had, you know, some good sense with it. But, you know, something that I also came across is that there are many people who are Christians and don't know that a lot of what they do is hoodoo. It's fascinating.
Some people call this book magical realism. I consider magical realism, like I associate that with writers from Latin America and the Caribbean. Do you consider this book a form of magical realism? Do you have your own label for what category this book might be considered?
I do not use the label magical realism. I am not against anyone calling it magical realism. I use Black surrealism when I describe my work. Mm. Mm-hmm. I think the work is more so a conversation with dream. And dream, not just the unconscious coming to the consciousness or coming to awareness, but also how we imagine or reimagine our world in a different way where reality has made it, it's made itself incompatible with what we need and what our lives truly are. There's a scholar, Dr. Lerone Martin. He used to be at Washington University. I don't know where he is now, but he gave a talk about Martin Luther King Jr., and he said he was one of the first Afro-surrealists because of his way of navigating the dream of what it would be like to be in an equal society. And it is because it was so unfathomable what he was imagining that it seemed unreal, impossible. But he was vehement about it becoming reality, even though he knew the challenges around doing that. And so I feel like my work is more so in line with that. I want to create a contemporary Black American mythology, and I need to lean into what is already there and what has claimed itself to be the logics of society, claimed itself to be rational, and say, well, maybe that is not enough. It isn't enough. It hasn't necessarily worked for us to be under the laws and systems of folks who can change those laws and systems to benefit themselves whenever. So I use Black surrealism, and sometimes I just even say it's mythological.
What do you say about revenge fantasies?
Oh, go for it. Why not? Why not? Or alternative history. I've heard it described that way because it's challenging to imagine something like that happening in the book where you have a conjure woman who is annihilating plantations, not just freeing people, but destroying them so that they can't ever return. And then those people are protected in their own way. You have to read the book to figure out how, but, you know, she does the best that she can in a world where a lot of us wish we had that as a possibility. Even now, folks are like, I wish I had Mia Ars.
Absolutely. And I wish I had a saint who could, you know, or Francis. Again, not giving anything away, but I want to just finish that thread about violence. I use the term revenge fantasy because you allow these characters to be violent in the wake of violence. Like, it's not just running away and escaping. And there are multiple ways that there's kind of this vengeance that women are allowed to get revenge, if you will. And they are allowed to be violent, which I'm enjoying very much, that women get to be just as violent in response to the violence that's put upon them. Can you just speak a little bit about that as you're thinking about mythology, as you're thinking about even the idea of a Black, new Black mythology even? Like, how does violence fit into that without it being gratuitous? Because it doesn't feel gratuitous at all. It feels very satisfying.
I like that word, satisfying. Violence, it happens. I do believe that we are animal. We're just in a particular, we're driven on a particular avenue of animality. So violence is a part of expression. Anger is a part of expression. Rage is a part of expression. The challenge is knowing when to be violent and when not to be violent. And in the book, it is first and foremost retaliation. It's self-defense. It's premeditated always, because there's a way where folks are saying like, oh, if it's a response, then it's not premeditated, but there's preparations that were made. So in that way, it's premeditated. It's at least a premeditated response. It's a way to know that when something does happen, if something happens, we are ready to protect ourselves. We are ready to defend our bodies. We are ready to defend other people. And we have confidence in doing that. We have our tools ready. We have the knowledge, the wisdom, and understanding. Things are passed down. These violences are passed down. And when violence is misused in the book, the repercussions are deadly. And so there's a way that the characters, they learn the hard way. You cannot have gratuitous violence. It cannot be, I'm going to use my powers however I want, because it will always return. And it's not karma. It's just the way that things are balanced out. So that's why I allow for there to be so many characters who get blood on their hands, quite literally, because why can't they? Why shouldn't they be able to do that after what has been done to them or around them? But maybe when they do something outside of that, it bites them back. It's then that's the lesson that they have to learn. You can't just be cruel and violent. There has to be a reason for it that balances out the nature of our existence and the way that we build community around us.
I would love to have you back like in a year, and then we can talk about the book openly. With all this, you know, like not give anything. Because one of the beautiful things about this book is that every single page, I feel like I'm surprised. I'm shocked. Oh my God. Like, you just don't know what's happening. Not like it's confusing, but like you've done such an amazing job of creating this world that we haven't seen before. I mean, we've gotten hints of it, but you have, like you said, like when you said mythology, it almost feels like that, but more grounded, not mythology where people are living up in the sky and, you know, the gods and what have you, but this other version of our world, which feels so familiar, but has such a bite, has such characters that feel so real and so grounded and yet so mythical and magical, which is just, it's so delicious. Like every single story in the story is so interesting and like unexpected and again, satisfying. So I don't want to give anything away because I feel like other than the basic idea of the story, you just got to get into it. You just have to see it and you have to be surprised by it. So I do want to jump to just a little bit more about your actual writing life. You said you started this book in college. You were no longer in college. I'm assuming you've been out of college for a good long time. So you've written many books also like in between there as well. So this book, Ours, again, it's like physically a huge book. It's gorgeous art on the cover. I hear people talking about the art just as much as what's inside the book. It's been on all of these, you know, anticipated, looking forward to. What kind of pressure does that put on you as a debut novelist in terms of, I don't know, what do you do next? How do you promote this book? Do you feel a level of expectation to be the most anticipated and this massive kind of rollout of your first novel? I just want to know, again, thinking as writers who might want to be in your place, you know, in the future, what does that feel like for you and how do you manage that level of expectation?
It helped that I had two books of poetry before the novel came out. I was already, I suppose, acquainted with this world in some ways. Poetry does not sell as much as fiction, so the attention that I'm getting now is new, but I don't feel pressure to do anything other than be myself and relax. And because what happens is people need to read the book and it's going to take a while for, well, some folks are reading the book in like 2 weeks, you know, they're really, they can't stop reading it. And that is, that's such an honor to have folks, you know, take this book in and say, I'm going, not only say that I'm going to read it, but I'm going to enjoy it. I'm going to take notes. I'm going to underline things, make tabs. Oh, I can't, there's not a better feeling than that. So I don't feel pressure. I feel honor. I feel seen in a way that I've not been seen before. I feel understood as a writer in a way that I've not been understood before. There are some things in Ours. It's like, I don't know if people, I hope they get it. And folks are getting it and finding things I didn't even know were in there. And so there's a release, there's a surrender that I'm able to have with Ours that is so refreshing. But as far as what the next book is going to be, I don't know. I have so many ideas. I know I'm still going to be writing poetry, but I don't feel pressure to be a superhero in the literary canon. You know, Toni Morrison really, she was writing great books from the beginning, but it took Song of Solomon, her third book, for people to understand that, oh yeah, she's the GOAT. Who knows how many books it'll take me? This is my third book, but it's my first novel. So I just feel grateful. I feel a lot of gratitude to have the readers, you know, to have you contact me and say, let's do this. That is something that is really important to me, to be celebrated and seen and want, you know, have people want to talk to me. So it's a very warm experience.
That's great. And I've heard you say in different interviews that when people are like, what do you want people to take from the book? And I've heard you say, and I'm paraphrasing, something like, whatever, it's not my job. Mm-hmm. Like they can take whatever they want. I think that's super helpful for writers because they feel so much pressure to, you know, like people have to get this from the book, or I had to write this book about X, Y, or Z. And you said something that just struck me that was like, I can't control what people are going to take from this book. So why would I even give you an answer to that when everybody's going to feel it differently? That seems like a super healthy way to put a piece of literature out into the world. Can you just talk about that for just a moment? Like what your feelings about that are?
It's none of my business. It's just none of my business. People can get from anything, let's talk about the writing in particular, but any art form with their own experiences, subjectivities, capabilities, level of, you know, empirical evidence, they bring to it so much that is invisible to me. To try to predict that would ruin the art. My responsibility is to make the book that comes to me that I've studied for, that I'm inspired to write. I'm not a writer of the messenger. There are messages in the book. I'm not completely sure what all of them are. I just know that I fell in love with a group of people who were in my head and they had things to say. And I wanted to render that with the most elegance, beauty, precision, and of course, political awareness, because I am someone who believes that there is a responsibility to community in that way. But whether someone reads my own intentions or my own inflections and gets the context or the subtext, I should say, that's exhausting to even imagine. I write the book and it's out of my hands. You do with it what you will. You know, you can draw pictures in it. I don't care. It's not, you spent your money on it to make a coloring book. That is your business.
Right. Okay. But, you know, it's such a healthy way of looking at your work. And it's putting it, like you said, it's putting in the same context of any other art. It's subjective. And for you to get hung up on people getting what you want them to get out of it, it's impossible, because everybody's going to come to it with a different starting point.
I will say this, though. There are ways where folks completely get a thing wrong. And you can't do anything about that, but that is frustrating. And it's usually, you know, folks you didn't even know who were going to read the book. It's like, oh, I didn't know you even read, you know, Black literature, let alone something that had these magical elements in it. So there is this way where I feel sometimes the urge to explain because they've gotten it so wrong for cultural reasons. But I let it go. I said, there are other readers who can correct them, that I have done my job.
And that's great. Let other readers correct them, or other critics who do get it, because you need to be off somewhere thinking of your next book. We all are going to need, after ours, it's like you have elevated the genre. Like, I'm going to need another magical book. I know. I'm like taking my time, and I've never written in a hardcover like this before. Like, I'm like, it's new, but I'm still going to underline this line. It's so beautiful. So as we wrap up, Philip, I always ask writers who come on the show, very important question. Do you have any particular writing rituals? So when you sit down to write, do you light candles? Do you sit in a special chair? Do you have jelly beans next to you? What are the things that you do to get yourself ready to start writing for real?
I can only write in a place that feels like home. So I usually write in home. In the office space, in the bedroom, I will lay on my stomach and just type, 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 type. Or I'll lay on my side and just type, 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 type. I cannot write in public places. So cafes, libraries, when there's a residency, I find myself not really being able to write. So I don't go to residencies. They don't help me to write. I will go to just clear my head and to talk to other artists. But to create a work, I have to be there for a long time. And usually they're just for a week or so. If I'm there for like a month or two, oh, I can get some writing done, because my body has become grounded in the space. So, year-long things that are like a month or more, sure, but it has to feel like home. There's always something to drink, water, pineapple juice, never under the influence. It's just a clear head. And sometimes with music, if it's music, it's the old stuff. So it's modal jazz, Nina Simone. I can't listen to R&B and write at the same time. I just can't do it. And what's one other thing? And a part of why it needs to feel like home is that I have to be able to at any moment fall asleep. Writing is exhausting. Writing is exhausting. And if I'm nodding off, I want to kick my feet up and just feel safe enough to close my eyes and rest. And then when I wake up, I'm in the space that I know I was not in danger of falling asleep in.
Interesting. Now that you say that, I'm wondering, like, how much of ours came out of like a dream state? I wonder, do you fall asleep and dream about some of the things, the scenes, the people, and do they come to you in your dreams at all?
I wish. I am very much awake and aware when the ideas are coming. It gets to the point where I'm pacing and talking it through. Like, if they did this, then what would happen? And then I'll ask the character, like, well, what do you want to do? And they'll tell me, like, you do not want to do that. I'm like, well, I want to do it. And so you'll know what I'm talking about. You know, there's a character who makes a decision that's a frightening one early in the book. And I was like, you sure you want to do that to her? He's like, yep. I was like, all right. And then you have to figure it out together how you'll get out of that.
I would love to be a fly on the wall watching you pace and talk to these characters. That would have been very interesting. So far, the last three authors on my show have mentioned Jelly Beans, Reese's Pieces, and I think it was like licorice. Do you have a snack of choice that, you know, when you just got the munchies while you're writing or you need something to like, I don't know, inspire you, you need a sugar rush or a salt rush? Is there a snack that you like to have nearby while you're writing?
Peanut butter and jelly.
Mmm.
Peanut butter and just enough protein, just enough sugar. It has a chew factor. Yeah, peanut butter and jelly.
When the pandemic hit, I was like, I started eating peanut butter and banana sandwiches, and it is now my go-to for exactly that reason. It's just enough protein, chew factor. It feels good. Doesn't slow me down though, right? Like it's not going to weigh me down and I can't be creative. Awesome. Well, thank you for sharing your writing rituals. I'm now going to imagine you laying in bed, writing your next masterpiece. Last thing, do you have a piece of advice, suggestion, wisdom for all the BIPOC writers listening right now to inspire them to keep writing and to keep telling their own unique stories?
Well, the first thing is to read more than you write. And to read everything, especially the works of our elders and our ancestors. It can't just be contemporary writing because that's an echo chamber. So definitely read, you know, the Jesmyn Wards, the Tia Williams, but get into some Gloria Naylor, you know, figure out how Amiri Baraka did his thing on the page and see what a master of craft does. I think there's a mistake that people think in the master as far as superiority. Mastery is when you know that you have the capability of asking good questions. And these people, they ask good questions, which is why their work was so influential. They knew what to explore and how to explore it. They didn't have the answers necessarily, but it seemed like they did because they had such rich minds. So read more than you write. Another one is to find a community that does more than up you. Now, you don't want them to put you down. That's an enemy. An enemy will put you down, but someone will say, you know, reconsider this. This isn't your strongest work here. This is really dope. Try to figure out how you did this. Someone who really, or a group of people who really understand what your vision is, and they want you to pursue it with the utmost rigor. And then the last piece of advice is to move towards complexity. It doesn't have to be difficult, but again, if it comes too easily, someone else has already said it. Trust me.
There you have it. Philip, you are amazing. And I wish I could take a class with you. And anybody looking for an MFA program, are you teaching at NYU right now? Did I read that correctly? Or where are you teaching right now?
Yeah, I teach at NYU with the In-Air Poetry program. And I am a founding faculty at Randolph Flores College. And they're writing MFA. Teaching poetry. I do not teach fiction. I don't have the fortitude. I teach predominantly poetry.
Smart. Know your limits, right? Like, awesome. Good for you. So if you want to go study with Philip, go to NYU or
Randolph College.
Randolph College. And I still feel like on your social media, you do a little bit of teaching. You do a lot of great sharing. So tell everybody where they can find you on social media, where they can buy your books. Where do you like to hang out the most on the interwebs?
So I am only on Instagram. I left Twitter because that place is a doomscape.
No judgment. So, No judgment.
And I had a pretty decent following on there. I said, it's not my mental health can't do Twitter. So I am on Instagram under Philip B, the letter B, the letter W, underscore author. That is my public page. The other page is for friends and folks I've met in real life. So follow me under Philip BW underscore author. And yeah, there are writing prompts there. Right now, because I had a new book out, it's a lot of just hours, but that'll change once I get tired of posting about the book. But I have to do publicity, y'all. It's part of it. But yeah, you get book recs on there. I'm going to start doing more video, you know, explaining some things in the writing world and my experiences. So yeah, please follow.
Excellent. And of course, we'll put all those links in the show notes. Thank you so much for being here and have a great rest of your launch period for ours.
This was so much fun. Thank you.
Did I lie or did Philip B. Williams deliver the truth? Don't you just want to jump right into your work right now and challenge yourself to make it better? Are you already making lists of poetry volumes that you might want to explore? Here are some key takeaways that you can apply right now to your writing life from this juicy and delicious conversation. Number one, read as much poetry as you can. And don't necessarily reach for what's popular. Read what challenges you and intimidates you. Two, don't be a fast food writer. You have to study to get good at writing. If it comes too easily, then it's probably been said before or it's just wrong. Number three, read more than you write and read the work of our literary ancestors. Read the masters because they have something to teach you about writing well. Number four, when you do read the masters, learn how to mimic their work, not copy it. Think of it as learning how to make your grandmama's sweet potato pie and then putting your own spin on it. And number five, find a community to support your writing, a community who understands your vision and will help you attain it. P.S. If you're a BIPOC woman, we have such a community called The Sanctuary, and you'll hear a little bit more about it later on. All right, I hope my conversation with Philip B. Williams has left you inspired and motivated to write. I hope you feel a deeper connection and commitment to your literary projects and practice. Don't forget Philip's epic and extraordinary novel, Ours, is available everywhere books are sold, including the Read, Write, and Create online bookstore, which is a better place to buy books and support authors and support indie booksellers than that other online retailer that rhymes with Glamazon. We will, of course, have links to Ours and Philip's award-winning poetry collections in the show notes, as well as links to his Instagram page. Thank you so much for listening to this award-winning podcast. I really hope it inspires you to keep writing and keep working on getting your words out into the world, because the world needs more BIPOC stories by BIPOC writers like you. If you're looking for more creative writing inspiration and useful resources for your literary life, then be sure to check out the Read, Write, and Create website. That's at Read, spelled R-E-E-D, writeandcreate.com. And while you're there, definitely sign up for the Read, Write, and Create monthly newsletter, which is the first place where you'll find out about my latest classes and creative offerings, as well as cool things to optimize and enjoy your literary lifestyle. And let's not forget, even award-winning author Philip B. Williams, Oprah's most anticipated author, said that writers need community. And I agree 100%. Yes, writing is a solitary activity, but a writing life shouldn't be, which is why I created The Sanctuary, which is a private membership community for BIPOC women writers who want to get published and get paid. What happens inside The Sanctuary? We offer writing workshops, co-writing sessions, author visits, beta readers for your work, and opportunities galore curated just for BIPOC women. These are opportunities to get published and get paid and to optimize your writing life. So if you're a BIPOC woman writer who's been searching for a supportive community and accountability for your writing projects, please visit the Sanctuary link on the Read, Write, and Create website. And also, we're going to put a link in the show notes. Thank you. The Read, Write, and Create podcast is written and produced by me, Lori L. Tharps. Our editor is Brad Linder, and our theme music is by Wattaboy. I'll be back in 2 weeks on Monday. Until then, keep writing.